This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, it's 6 a.m. Wednesday, the 6th of July, and of course you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Xiaoling in the studio, and in an undisclosed location somewhere in Selangor is Shahzana Mukhtar joining us.
Good morning, good morning. I can disclose the location. I am in Puchong, the very unfashionable neighborhood of Puchong in Selangor.
It is not unfashionable. Why do you say that?
Because you guys are, well, that's true. Perhaps it's, but it's, I think it's perfectly wonderful to live in Puchong. I love my neighborhood. But yes, I don't really hear a lot of people saying, oh, I'm going to spend my weekend in Puchong. That's quite unheard of.
Yeah, but a lot of people drive all the way there for some of KL's best food. Okay, so
and
don't
we have
diss
a couple
it.
Of We have a couple of hiking trails also that are pretty popular. So
really?
If you haven't made your way here, you'll want to come to Puchong, yeah.
Okay, that is new to me. I never knew there were hiking trails in Puchong. I know about Shah Alam. I know about, you know, Gassing Hill.
Oh no, this was supposed to be our secret. Now I've let the cat out of the bag. We're going to see more crowds here than we are used to.
Your neighbors are going to give you a death stare when you leave your house next time, okay? Because they were like, oh, this is the woman that let everyone know about the wonderful trails of Puchong. But nonetheless, we always on The Morning Run have a packed show, an interesting show. At 7:15, we're going to be talking about whether businesses are ready to implement a four-day week. We're going to discuss this. And I think, you know, what's going to be interesting is there are going to be a myriad of, I guess, views on this. We're going to talk to Ridhima Khadija of Kincentric Malaysia. And then at 7:30, what's happening, Shaz?
Well, we're going to be taking a look down south at Singapore, because the Singapore property market remains piping hot despite cooling measures instituted by the government last December. So we'll be discussing the outlook for the rest of the year with Alan Chong of Savills.
Yeah, I wish they could transfer some of the heat to our KL property market, which has been, I would say, rather in the doldrums for the last few years.
Then indeed.
And then at 7:45, we're going to be asking about whether the inclusion of union members onto the boards of GLCs and GLICs are a good idea. We're going to get reactions from Leah Rahman of the Institutional Investors Council. And yes,
if you're making travel plans abroad, I think you should tune into the Breakfast Grill today, because you'll be speaking to a very interesting guest, Xiaoling.
Yeah, it's Apple Vacation. Some of y'all might have actually taken tours with them. I hear they're very popular. I haven't been on one. But we're going to speak to Dato' Sri Kok Yok Heng. He's a co-founder and group managing director, for a little channel check as to the recovery of the outbound tourism sector. And, you know, maybe now is the time for you to book that holiday. What are prices really like? So all this and more on The Morning Run. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. 6:09, Wednesday, the 6th of July. And of course, you're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Xiaoling together with Shahzana Mukhtar. And that song was Do It Again by Steely Dan. Hopefully not mistakes though. But up next, we've got a story from the South China Morning Post. And it's a very long, wordy title. It's Indonesia, Portugal and South Africa mild digital nomad visas. But how to define exactly what work is and where is it happening? So this article is just basically all about the different countries that are attracting, like we say, digital nomads by offering them different visas in terms of like the duration they can stay in the country. What are the qualifications for you to apply for these visas, and why this phenomenon is on the rise?
So I thought this was a really interesting op-ed piece, and I learned a lot in terms of how many countries in the world offer a specific visa for digital nomads. About 46 countries. So that's not, I think that was more than I expected, really, that had a particular visa to allow people to work remotely. And the fact is that more countries are looking into this, especially after 2 years of the pandemic, right? I think all countries are really trying to find a way to bring travelers back to their shores after 2 years of shutdown. So I'm not surprised that countries like Indonesia and South Africa are considering this. But I do wonder, I suppose, how widespread this will become, and how effective this really is in attracting people to come stay and spend, because that's what you want, for people to come to your country and spend on your economy.
Yeah, but without putting a strain on local services like healthcare, perhaps, and also to contribute to what we do see as over-tourism or over-development, right? So it's almost you want the cream of visitors. Let's call them long-term visitors, which they really are, right?
And this reminds me of Airbnb, actually, because I'm sure companies like Airbnb would love these kinds of work arrangements. We spoke about this earlier in the year about how they are allowing their employees to work, I think it's some 90 days out of the year in a foreign location. So it's countries like this that offer these specific visas that would be attractive to, I suppose, tech platforms like Airbnb that have employees who can work around the world.
Yeah. And added to this, I think to attract these longer term visitors is that there's no income tax requirement to pay to the country that you're staying in, provided you're not actually working or using the, working with the local companies. It's kind of like whatever work you do is with your own home country or anywhere else but that country. I just wonder whether is this really going to take off? Because increasingly more and more, we got into this phenomena where we thought, hey, everyone can work remotely. Everyone is working from home. But we see increasingly the trend is for more and more people to say, come back to the office, come back to the office. We need that interaction. We need to have everyone in the office so that we can have those ideas. And even some people want to come back to the office because they're honestly quite tired of being at home. But digital nomad is a whole different ballgame, right? Because you're leaving to go to another country completely. Yeah. And if that option was available to me and I could afford it, I'd be like, yay! I mean, you get the best of both worlds, right? You get like a semi-holiday, and then at the same time, you get to work wherever you want at your pace. But I really do think it's just not available for every profession.
Absolutely. I mean, it's very specific to certain industries, probably the tech industry, probably someone who can work on your computer. And I think even for countries that want to institute this kind of visa program, I feel like there's still a lot of nuances or a lot of factors that need to be taken into account, right? Like what counts as digital work? Like I imagine somebody working for Airbnb can make a solid case for being a digital nomad. But what if you're self-employed? What if your job is as an influencer? What if your job is posting videos to YouTube? How do you quantify that this is work and not something I do as a hobby? I mean, it's just, for me, there just seems to be a lot of criteria involved that need to be fleshed out in order for this to be more solid.
Yeah. So this article cites Thailand as an example of the confusing rules with regards to it, right? So like for example, if you're a travel blogger and you set up shop in Thailand, would it be considered breaching the visa rules if you were writing articles about traveling in Thailand, for example? Or if you were, let's say, doing some sort of business online and it was selling handicrafts, would that be considered business if you were promoting Thai products? All these questions, right? There doesn't seem to be an easy answer.
Yeah, and it all comes back because countries still want to make tax income. So how much leeway can you give to these digital nomads coming in? It's like that balance of what's the trade-off, right?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. Let's really see how many people sign up for this, whether it becomes really a common trend. And we don't have one in Malaysia, do we? Why not?
Not that I know of. I mean, but
we have Malaysia, my second home, where there was this back and forth with regards to policy. And I know in Malaysia, you're not supposed to work. That's for sure. But digital nomad, it's not such a bad idea, right? Maybe we can earn revenue from these long-term travelers. Shall I call them that?
Yeah, it's worth considering. But I feel like in our case, I'm not sure we're quite ready to institute this visa program without there being a lot of problems in the mix.
But let us know what you think. You can tweet in at BFM Radio. You can WhatsApp in at 018-789-8899. And let us know whether you would like to be a digital nomad, and if you could, where would you go? Keep it here, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Wong Xiaoning with Shazana Mokhtar. And that was the Still Sounds by Toro Oemoa. Very cool vibe. It is 6:20 in the morning, Wednesday, 6th of July. And we're continuing our little, I guess, vacation theme going on here.
Because travel,
vacation.
All about travel.
We all have that wanderlust within us, right? Because later on at the Breakfast Grill, I'll be speaking to Apple Vacations boss. So do tune in. That's happening after the 8 a.m. news bulletin. But Shazana, you chose this article. It's from Bloomberg. And it's all about Venice. The headline is Venice plans to start weeding out cheap tourists. Does this mean we can't go?
Well, I think you've pipped us because you actually recently came back from Venice, Xiaoning. So I really wanted to get your opinions, actually, on what it was like on that island after 2 years of pandemic lockdown where no tourists could come. Have tourists started returning to Venice in a big way?
Yes. I mean, I don't think in a big, big way, but So to my untrained eye, because I obviously hadn't been there in a very, very long time, so I have no reference point. But even then, I thought, hey, there's still quite a lot of people here on this tiny, tiny islands, right? I mean, it's Venice, there's a main island, but there are smaller islands around it. But I was really mainly on the main island. And I already thought, wow, quite a lot of people, pretty congested, right? And it's an unusual island because, you know, there are no cars. Everybody walks or they take the water ferries here and there. And it's like, to be honest, it's extremely commercial. Everyone there is somehow one way or another related to tourism, whether it's a restaurant, whether it's a shop, whether it's a hotel, museums. They're all interconnected. But I had also interesting conversations with locals. And let me tell you, they did really suffer when there were no tourists.
The economy really relies on visitors, essentially. Yeah. It's visitors that make everything go round.
Yeah, but the island also still has, I think if I remember correctly, close to maybe 60,000, 80,000 local residents who make Venice their home. I mean, most people actually take the ferry to come in to work and then they take the ferry to go out. Because Venice in itself, I would say, is extremely expensive, even by Italian standards, right? Because, and you can understand why, because everything is brought in specially for this island, whether it's fruits, vegetables, bottled water, drinks, everything is, and it's hand brought in because there are no roads, right? So people use carts to transport everything. It's almost medieval in a funny way. Now, whether this argument, whether you should charge day trippers, I can understand why. Because if you're a Venice resident, what you want is, yes, you still want to rely on tourism because there is the necessity. Otherwise, everything comes to a grinding halt. But you want the high-value tourists, which I think Venice at the current moment doesn't seem to see a lot of. So I do see a lot of day trippers, but actually because it is so expensive. Hotels are just pricey. Even at the, you know, it's very hard to get anything affordable.
So when I read this story, I had a lot of mixed feelings about it because on one hand, I can understand why you'd want to manage the traffic of visitors to an island that's so small that could be overwhelmed by the resources needed to cater to that huge demand, right? I think prior to the pandemic, Venice saw some 20 million visitors a year. I mean, we'd be lucky to get that many visitors to Malaysia in a year. And this is just like one part of an island of an entire country. But on the other hand, I'm thinking like, so what does that mean? Does that mean you block Venice? Where does the access go to, right? Yeah. Is it only the wealthy who get to access this very rich heritage? So that's the kind of warring factions within me when I see measures such as this. But at the same time, I do feel like perhaps something needs to be done in order to preserve Venice for the future, because it's not just over tourism that they're suffering from, but there's also the impact of climate change. And it doesn't help if it's being inundated by more people than it can handle every single year.
Yeah. So when I look at their plans, right, the city plans to charge day trippers a fee of between 3 to 10 euros for access starting in January. I think they haven't really finalized the details yet as to how to charge and enforce the fees and whether, you know, they're going to target just the hotspots, so like whether it's the Grand Canal or St. Mark's Square, how they're going to implement this is still up in the air. But I think if it's between 3 to 10 euros and if it's at the lower end of the scale, it's still relatively affordable when you consider that a coffee in Europe is like a euro or two.
I'm curious whether this rule would apply both to locals and foreigners or if it's just meant for foreigners. And if we take, I guess, just zooming out to like tourism more broadly, I'm wondering if this kind of measure will become more, more commonplace, especially for tourism spots that have very environmentally sensitive locations, like Mount Everest. When I saw this, I immediately thought of Mount Everest and just how inundated with people they get and the impact that has on the environment there.
Well, I've been to one place where the rules are even stricter and the cost is very exorbitant, and that was Bhutan, right? That's $250 spent a day. So you have countries implementing that. It's always the balance between conservation and, you know, how do and development, where's the sweet spot? And I think countries are still trying to find their way. But up next, we've got the 6:30 a.m. news bulletin. And to take us there is Everybody Wants to Rule the World by Tears for Fears. Keep it here, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, and that was Danny California by the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I hope it certainly woke you up. It is The Morning Run. I'm Wong Xiaoning together with Shazana Mokhtar, 6:40 Wednesday, the 6th of July. And I see flashes of lightning and thunder out there, so I'm not sure whether it's going to rain. But before we look at international headlines, Shaz, you've got a fan out there who also agrees that Puchong is a fantastic place to stay. She said, good morning. I moved from PJ to Puchong Prima in February this year and I just love it here. And this is from Shatini.
All right, Shatini, my Puchong peeps. Yes. Yes, Puchong is a great place to stay.
Yeah, well, one person who probably doesn't feel as good as y'all two ladies out there is Bojo this morning, Boris Johnson. Lots of headlines coming out of the UK. We woke up to the news at 4 a.m. that his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, has resigned. And so has Health Secretary Sajid Javid.
These are two powerhouses in his cabinet, okay? These are two of the most important positions, health secretary and chancellor that handles all the country's finances, that both of them have said that they've lost confidence in him. It has to be a huge blow to the prime minister.
Yeah, so Bloomberg has reported that he was quick to replace them. So education secretary Nadhim Zahawi and cabinet office minister Stephen Barclay to Sunak's and Javid's roles respectively. Now, Johnson apparently determined to stay on as prime minister, but I think these cabinet resignations and, of course, a string of other MPs in the last few months are junior roles. I think clearly, I don't know whether it's the rats leaving the sinking ship kind of situation going on in the UK.
I mean, this is triggered by the case of Member of Parliament Chris Pincher, who stepped down recently because of allegations of sexual harassment against him. And it was purported that the prime minister knew about this when he appointed Chris Pincher to the position of deputy vice whip in parliament back in 2020. So there were allegations back as far back as 2019 and even before that. So people are questioning essentially Boris Johnson's integrity and really questioning what he stands for, that he would in the appointments that he makes.
Yeah, but he does have his supporters, Boris Johnson. So Dominic Raab, who's Deputy Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary Liz Truss, Defence Secretary Ben Wallace and Levelling Up Secretary Michael Gove have all indicated they were staying on and supporting him. But let's just see how long this support will last. Because even Alex Chalk, who's the Solicitor General, was the third minister to quit Johnson's government. In the letter, right, he said the ability of Number 10 to upload the standards of candor expected of a British government has irretrievably broken down. Ouch.
I mean, don't forget that not too long ago, I think it was just a couple of weeks ago, Boris Johnson did survive a no confidence vote among Conservative MPs. So technically, under the rules, he cannot go through another confidence vote for a year. But now everyone's asking, will these rules be changed so that another confidence motion can be called against the prime minister? He's essentially clinging to his post. You know, he's on the cliff and he's hanging on by his fingertips. Will there be more resignations from his cabinet and from his party after this? I mean, I think that's what everyone's watching. He's in quite a precarious position at this moment.
Yeah, so even Brexit negotiator Lord Frost says that a new prime minister is needed. I would really wonder how Boris Johnson is going to get out of this. What trick is he going to take out of his little hat? Because he seems to be running out of options. But at the same time, right, he's like the prime minister that's made out of Teflon. Nothing seems to stick whatsoever, you know.
That's right. There's been so many scrapes and skirmishes against him. He has been fined for criminal offences during the pandemic for breaching pandemic lockdown restrictions. Partygate, that's right. So even with the criminal offence to his name, that hasn't stopped him from still staying in power. And even prior to that, you know, there've been allegations of misappropriation of funds as well in terms of renovating his apartment. But nothing really came out of that either. So yeah, maybe he's just like a cat with nine lives. How many lives has he used up? You know, we're still counting.
8.5, but let's see. I shouldn't be guessing. But very quickly, we'll have some other business news for you. And one of which is that it's actually from Bloomberg and it's about the Asia's biggest IPOs to watch out for in the second half. So some interesting names are Syngenta Group. They are from China, seed and fertilizer giant. Off Business, which is an Indian startup, Beer Co., which is something actually has been delayed, restarted, and then delayed. They are Thai Bev's brewery unit. They tried twice to go public in Singapore, but now they're going to try for third time lucky. KBank, which is South Korea's only online bank. This one's going to be interesting in terms of setting a valuation basis for online banking, digital banking. Rakuten Bank, and even the Chinese Tourism Group Duty Free Corp. And of course, the final one, N Group Co. So lots of excitement in the capital market space, despite the fact that I think recession fears are really setting in.
I think that's those are the competing forces at play, right? So on one hand, people are getting worried about the recession, but on the other hand, there are these IPOs that want to list. So it's going to be interesting to see how much traction they get, whether people will be enticed to part with their money and invest, or whether they're going to go, you know, no, it's not safe yet. I'm going to hang on to my cash.
Or I wonder whether these corporates are also thinking, okay, I better quickly list before the market really turns and the sentiment kind of drifts off the cliff and everyone's totally risk off. And I also can't ask for certain kind of valuations that I want. So maybe there's a rush to list at this moment. But, you know, when the valuations are great, they'll always be buyers. But up next, we've got some messages. Keep it here. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, 6:50, Wednesday, 6th of July. And that was Should I Stay or Should I Go by The Clash. And that was dedicated to Boris Johnson.
Nice one, Xiaoning. Nice one.
Yeah, I think it's very apt. But I think knowing him in his mind, he'll probably say, I should stay. But I guess let's see what the Conservative Party thinks. They might really think you should go. But now we turn our attention to local headlines. And, you know, the stories coming out of Baling are really catching my eye. It's in the Star, page 3, Baling hit by the worst ever floods. And, you know, there's already been 3 people unfortunately dead and hundreds displaced as waters come rushing in. So it's quite a sad situation at the moment. But I think the PM has ordered for immediate aid for Baling flood victims, but at the moment there's still no state of emergency called.
That's right. So Prime Minister Datuk Sri Ismail Sabri Yaakob is in Turkey at the moment, but he said that there will be aid amounting to 500,000 ringgit for the flood victims, with compassionate payment of 100,000 ringgit, as well as basic necessities aid of 2,500 ringgit for every household affected by the floods. So again, this is a very tragic occurrence, not something that anybody wants to happen.
Yeah.
At this time of year, so especially just before the religious festivities of Hari Raya Haji, I mean, it's terrible for the people on the ground there for sure.
Although the Kedah Menteri Besar has requested for a level 1 or 2 emergency to be declared in the areas so that they could speed up operations by state and federal agencies. Now, what's interesting is that the Star cites, while many blame rampant logging for the floods, Energy and Natural Resources Minister has said that no active logging activities have been reported in the Gunung Inas Forest Reserve area that could have led to this water surge phenomenon. He said forest development was being carried out for reforestation purposes, and so far more than 5,000 trees have been planted in this 52-hectare area, which suggests that trees were in the first place taken away. Or chopped down.
I think it may be premature to, I guess, say what caused it. Exactly.
I feel like to
say that while things are happening is a little bit too early, really. And one doth protest too much, I feel.
Yeah.
But yes, hopefully there will be more details coming out when everybody is safe and when people can start to recover after the floods have receded.
Yeah, the other local news that I want to highlight is the fact that Bank Negara is meeting today. The MPC will come up with a decision whether to keep interest rates currently where they are, which is at 2%, following this 25 basis point hike, a bit of a surprise in May. Or will they actually raise it by another 25 basis points? I think many economists, and this is according to The Star, are projecting at least a 50 basis point hike within the next 6 months, which will bring the policy rate to 2.5%.
That's going to be something to watch, isn't it? I think everyone sees that there will be rates will increase, but the timing has always been in question. I think things have changed as we see the situation develop over in the US and in Europe with the war still going on and with the recession seeming more and more likely. It's all about the timing.
Yeah, I think the twin pressures of inflation whilst trying to manage or actually encourage growth is something central bankers are, the dilemma central bankers are faced with. So even in Malaysia, although officially CPI remains very benign, I think the cost of living pressure is really there. And nobody will say it officially, but the ringgit, of course, is one consideration. And the US dollar has continued to strengthen. Even this morning, it's 4.4193 against the greenback. So whether Bank Negara feels the heat to raise the rates, especially within the region, there has been rate hikes. I mean, the Bank of Australia did so, and they were quite slow to start, and now they've been more aggressive. So we'll definitely be watching this space. What else has caught your eye, Shaz?
Well, I am following a bunch of political headlines. And right now, what seems to be in the spotlight is the number two of UMNO, Datuk Sri Muhammad Hassan. He has had an interview with Asia Times, and there's a bit of a conflict.
He said, she didn't say.
You know, they said, I said, what happened? So the Asia Times reported that Tok Mat, as he is popularly known, has said that Datuk Sri Najib Razak, former prime minister, should go to jail if his conviction is upheld. Tok Mat has come out to say, no, my comments were taken out of context. But Asia Times have stood by the reporting and have even issued the recording of the interview to say that, no, we reported exactly what he said. So you can judge for yourself whether there's been a spin on the reporting or whether, you know, they reported what Tok Mat said. But yeah, there seems to be a bit of a kerfuffle with Tok Mat and within UMNO about what's going to happen. And I think one of the things that was interesting about what Tok Mat's interview was, he said that there should be an election because the current government is a backdoor government. Mm. But you see, UMNO was part of creating that backdoor government.
Yeah, exactly.
So he's essentially talking about his own government. It's a little bit confusing for me, I have to say, but I'm interested to see how this all plays out and what happens between friends.
For the moment. But what I think is indicative of is that there are clearly factions within the party, right? And even very quickly, the Star page too, they highlight that at a Barisan national dinner 5 days ago, Dato' Sri Ismail Sabri made an unusual appeal. He asked Barisan parties not to criticise him because if they did, he said it would be at the coalition's expense at the ballot box. At the ballot box. So it's obvious that pressure on the Prime Minister to call for a general election is mounting. That's the commentary, actually, from Terence Tan. But that's all the local news we have for you. Up next, we have the 7 a.m. news. And to take us there is Praise You by Fatboy Slim. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.